Well, we come this evening then to our 10th and penultimate study in the life of Jacob. And you might be thinking that I've planned this series rather badly, in that I'm now going to be away 2 weeks before I can deliver the final address. And I admit that's not an ideal situation, but I don't think that it should actually matter all that much. Up until now, I suppose each episode in the life of Jacob that we've looked at has very much flowed out of the preceding one. But with our final study, that won't really be the case so much. Our final study will really actually be trespassing upon the life of Joseph and just picking up on the odd little window that we're given here and there into the last part of Jacob's life. And so, as I say, I don't think that it should be too disastrous to have this break now, so close to the finishing line of this series. Well, I want to look tonight then at chapter 35, and I'd like us to look at it in two parts, noticing first of all this evening a happy sequel in verses 1 to 8. Now, you may remember that last chapters 33 and 34, under the three headings, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And the ugly, of course, was the sequence of events that is related to us in chapter 34, the rape of Jacob's daughter Dinah, somewhere in the vicinity of Shechem, and the subsequent bloody massacre carried out by Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, as they put to the sword the entire city of Shechem. And we said then that while the violence of Simeon and Levi there in chapter 34 is excessive and lacks a sense of proportion, the narrator actually seems to set forth Jacob as the real object of our disapproval. He's the primary object, I think, of our disapproval, as we read chapter 34. He's at the other extreme, you see, from Simeon and Levi. He is just pathetically passive and inactive, seemingly indifferent to the horror of what has taken place, his daughter Dinah being raped. And you may remember that we identified three reasons for Jacob's indifference and passivity there in chapter 34. First of all, we said that Jacob is a bad parent in chapter 34. He doesn't really care all that much about the rape of his daughter Dinah because he doesn't really have all that much love for his daughter Dinah, because Dinah is the daughter of the least loved wife, Leah. But then secondly, we said that Jacob has a low view of sin in that passage. Remember, he has settled in Shechem. Of course, he should never have done that. He should have been making his way straight to Bethel as soon as he arrived back in Canaan, but he has settled in Shechem. And there, it seems, in Shechem, he has become somewhat adjusted to the moral climate of Shechem, so that he isn't shocked by this terrible atrocity of a young, vulnerable woman being sexually assaulted. He doesn't recognize it as a disgrace, which his sons rightly recognize it to be in verse 7 of chapter 34. But then thirdly, we said that Jacob is driven by self-interest there in chapter 34. We discover in verse 30 that he's scared of the Canaanites and Perizzites. Clearly, if he stands up and speaks out against the sinful behavior of the Shechemites, that might well incur a cost for Jacob, and it's a cost that he is not prepared to incur. He's not prepared to stick his head above the parapet. He's not prepared to enter the fray on behalf of the laws and standards of his God. And so, to cut a long story short, Genesis 34 is not exactly a high point in the career of Jacob. But, as our heading indicates. This first part of chapter 35 really does represent a wonderfully and remarkably happy sequel. In verse 1 we read, "Then God said to Jacob, 'Go up to Bethel and settle there, and build an altar there to God, who appeared to you when you were fleeing from your brother Esau.'" And it seems to me that those words in verse 1 really do bear remarkable testimony to the grace of God. Here's Jacob, and he has well and truly lost his way. Many years earlier, he had vowed to God at Bethel in chapter 28 that upon his eventual return to Canaan, he would go to Bethel and would build an altar there and would worship God there, and he would offer indeed a tenth of all the possessions with which God had blessed him. And doubtless Jacob, still at the back of his mind, harbored the intention someday to do that. Doubtless there was a vague intention in Jacob's mind that someday he would indeed fulfill that vow and go to Bethel and worship God there. But Jacob had foolishly allowed himself to become settled in Shechem. And there in Shechem, God and the things of God had become somewhat remote to Jacob, to the point at which this man who a few years earlier had threatened to kill anyone who was discovered to have stolen Laban's gods now is relatively indifferent to something far worse than stealing a few household gods: the sexual assault of a vulnerable young woman. Jacob, as I say, has well and truly left. And as a reader, you don't really see at the end of chapter 34 any way in which he's going to recover his way. You don't see how he's going to get back on track. You don't really see how on earth he's going to get back on his Christian pilgrimage once more. But here in verse 1 of chapter 35, God comes to Jacob. And gently but firmly, God gives Jacob the nudge that he needs to get back on track. And it's as if he says to Jacob, "Look, Jacob, what are you doing here? What are you doing in Shechem? What are you doing settled down here? Get yourself out of Shechem. Get yourself to Bethel, Jacob. Go and build the altar that you vowed to me all those years ago you would build." Hasn't God often treated us like that? With the same grace? Haven't there been times when those vows which we made ardently, the vows which perhaps we even sang regularly in church, "Take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee," times when those vows have fallen into disrepair in our own personal Shechems? Perhaps your Shechem was your school years. Perhaps your Shechem was that period when you got involved with a non-Christian boyfriend or girlfriend. Perhaps your Shechem was when you first began your employment and for the first time you had money at your disposal. Perhaps your Shechem was that period when your hobby, which previously you had had control of, suddenly had control of you. Or whatever your personal Shechem might have been, it was a period when you were becalmed spiritually. The wind went out of your sails. God and the things of God became remote to you. You had well and truly lost your way. And yet God came to you, like he came to Jacob. And whether it was through a sermon that you heard, a verse of scripture he brought back to your remembrance, whether it was through the comment of a Christian friend, whether it was through a providential sequence of events in your lives, somehow or other, he gave you that nudge that you needed to get back on track. He propelled you out of your Shechem and enabled you to restart your Christian pilgrimage once again. What a gracious God we have. What relentless, long-suffering, persevering grace in this God who bears with us in all our personal Shechems. My soul he doth restore again, and me to walk doth make within the paths of righteousness, even for his own name's sake. But I think there's another token of God's grace in this verse as well, and it's the detail in the second half of the verse. Build an altar there to God to you when you were fleeing from your brother Esau. What's the point of that detail? Why does God add that about how he had appeared to him when he fled from his brother Esau? Well, I think the point is, God is saying to Jacob, look, I know that you have made a mess of things, Jacob. I know all about Shechem. I know that there at Shechem, you have let your daughter Dinah down, you have let yourself down, supremely you have let me, your God, down. You have messed up, well and truly, good and proper, there at Shechem. And I know, Jacob, that you're probably thinking that my relationship with you is over now, that it's finished. Or at the very least, that it's been profoundly altered on the basis of your recent conduct. Well, Jacob, I've got news for you. It hasn't. It hasn't. I still look on exactly the same footing as I did all those years ago on that heady night when I appeared to you in that dream when you were fleeing from your brother Esau. Nothing's changed, Jacob. You want to know how I feel about you, Jacob, what I think of you, Jacob, today, right here at this moment. Well, think Bethel. Go back to Bethel. That will give you an idea. Nothing's changed. The sin that has taken place since then, the series of sins culminating in this terrible episode at Shechem, have not altered or modified for one moment my relationship with you. And again, God treats us like that. So often, when we're coming back from our Shechems, from our far countries, from our periods of sin and backsliding, we just hope that at the very most, God will treat us as one of his hired men. And yet, every single time, and perhaps some of you need to grasp that anew this evening, because you're right now on your way back from some backsliding. You're right now repenting of some gross sin in your life. Well, let me persuade you, every single time, God runs to us, and God embraces us, and God kisses us, and God gets out the robe for us, and the sandals for us, and the ring for us, and he kills the fattened calf for us, and he treats us like royalty. He relates to us, in other words, on exactly the same footing once again as always he did in the past. Nothing has changed. Our sin hasn't modified for one moment his relationship with us. Remarkable testimony then to the grace of God there in verse 1. And Jacob, you see, responds, doesn't he, to that grace. And we read in verse 2, so Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, get rid of the foreign gods you have with you, and purify yourselves, and change your clothes. Then come, let us go up to Bethel, where I will build an altar to God. And I suppose the basic thing that we see there is Jacob taking responsibility and giving to his family, to his household, and unambiguous instructions about preparing to worship God at Bethel. And in a way, that's exactly what he wasn't doing back in chapter 34. There in chapter 34, in the of Dinah, his sons were looking to Jacob for guidance. They were looking to their father, the head of their home, to take a lead. They were looking to him for guidance as they had suddenly been exposed to the loose sexual of these pagan Shechemites they were living amongst. They were looking to him as to how they, as circumcised men, as servants of Jehovah, should respond to these loose sexual morals of the Shechemites. But of course, there in chapter 34, they got absolutely no guidance from Jacob whatsoever. Jacob remained silent. He didn't take a lead. And in his failure to take a lead, his sons had to take the matter into their own hands and respond in their own way to what had happened. It raises a question for those of us this evening who are heads of homes, heads of households. Are we more like the Jacob of chapter 34 who failed to give to his children, to his family, the guidance that they needed? Do we fail to give to our children especially, but also our wives, the guidance that they need in a confusing world where they are surrounded by morals and standards and values that are coming at them from all kinds of different directions? Are we weak and passive and inactive like Jacob there? Or are we heads of homes more like the Jacob of chapter 35, giving those explicit and detailed instructions to his family in how to worship God? It's a challenge for those of us who are in that position this evening. Well, what are his instructions? Well, his instructions are, first of all, get rid of the foreign gods you have with you. Or we go to Bethel to worship the God. And that's challenging, isn't it? I wonder how often we come here on a Sunday to worship God, and all we're really doing is adding a little bit of Jehovah worship to the worship of celebrities, the worship of our team, the worship of our grandchildren, the worship of our career that we've been engaged in during the week. Well, this is reminding us it doesn't work like that. Our God is a jealous God, and he'll not be simply tagged on at the end of a whole pantheon of other deities. Other gods, other objects of worship must first be renounced before we can worship our God properly. But then the other instruction he gives them is to purify yourselves and change your clothes, which really I think are just two parts of the same thing. And this, I think, the point here is that not only is Jacob's household to renounce the foreign gods they have, but they are also to renounce what has just taken place at Shechem. Because, you see, that means by purifying yourselves in the wake of this sin, this ugly episode. And the changing of their clothes is just really a visible expression. Would have been torn, their clothes would have been sweaty, their clothes would have been bloodstained from the massacre and the looting of Shechem. And in taking off those clothes and in replacing them with clean clothes, it was a visible expression of this renunciation of what had taken place there at Shechem. And we've referred, haven't we, once or twice in previous weeks to that principle in Matthew 5, that before we offer our gifts at the altar of God, before we worship God, we must first be reconciled to our estranged brothers. And we've said, haven't we, that Jacob has been attending to that gradually. He's got reconciled now to Laban, and he's got reconciled now to Esau. But this, here in these first verses of chapter 35, is just the final piece of the jigsaw, really. It's the final act of preparation for worshipping God. And it's a reminder, isn't it, that preparing to worship God doesn't just mean sorting out those quarrels and those estrangements and those bust-ups that there are in our lives with the Esau's and Laban's of this world. It means renouncing all kinds of sin, not just quarrels and feuds, but the whole spectrum, the whole range of sins. If we've massacred a city, I don't suppose many of us have done that this week, but if we've massacred a city, we have to renounce that. Or more pertinently, if we've just been very weak and passive and have withdrawn ourselves from God's battles as Jacob had done in chapter 34, we have to renounce that as well before we can come and properly worship God. That's why in most of our services, early on in our service, express to God our confession for our sins. In many Christian churches, that's done corporately, the congregation publicly reciting a confession. And this isn't just some tradition that has developed randomly. This is a vital principle that sin must be renounced in the worship of God. We can't just charge in from a week of disobeying our parents and worship God as if there's nothing inconsistent in that. We can't charge in from a week of relentlessly pursuing money and recognition and self-aggrandizement and then worship God as if there's nothing inconsistent in that. Sin must be renounced in the worship of God, and Jacob was taking that principle seriously. And so then, Jacob indeed proceed to Bethel, and the altar is indeed built in verse 7. And so, as I say, this first part of the chapter is a very happy sequel, really, a remarkably happy sequel to the ugliness and darkness of chapter 34, as now at last the worship that has been long vowed takes place. The second part of the passage that we'll be looking at is much briefer, so don't get too agitated. I just want to mention one other thing, which doesn't really fit into either of my two headings, unfortunately, but I think is worth commenting on. It's the detail in verse 8, where we read this: "Now Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried, and was buried under the oak below Dalon Bacuth." And what's remarkable about it isn't the death itself. We're not told anything about that. She was probably an old lady, this woman, Deborah. But it's the sheer fact it's recorded. It's there in Scripture. And that's particularly remarkable when you consider that Rebekah's death isn't recorded. Rebekah, the wife of Isaac, the mother of Jacob, her death isn't recorded, but the death of her nurse, Deborah, is. When you read the narratives of Jacob's life, you soon begin to appreciate that the narrator is a master of his craft, and he's constantly introducing just little details which make a much more telling contribution to the overall story than you first realize, and just in some subtle way they influence our interpretation of various episodes of Jacob's life and so on. But neither I nor can see any such literary merit really in this verse here, verse 8 of chapter 35. It doesn't really have any important contribution or any significant impact upon anything else beyond itself. It just seems an utterly isolated verse with, as I say, no particular literary merit. And it makes me wonder whether perhaps this verse isn't actually reflecting anything of the agenda of the narrator. It's not reflecting anything in the narrator's agenda. Perhaps the narrator didn't even really know why he was writing this down. But I think it was probably purely reflecting the agenda of the ultimate author, God. The God about whom we sang earlier on in Psalm 116, verse 15. "The Lord holds dear the death of all his saints." And here we have this woman, Deborah. And her death wasn't significant in terms of the political landscape of the ancient Near East. And her death wasn't perhaps even all that significant even within the very household that she'd spent her life serving in. But it was significant to God, because this woman was a saint. She was his child. She was his servant. And I think perhaps it reflects nothing else, but it reflects that. It reflects the heart of God that is engaged by the death of his saints. 1997, our whole nation seemed to suddenly become obsessed by the death of a certain princess. And still, 10 years on, millions of people will turn on the television to watch a pop marking that same death. But you know, it's not the deaths of princesses that God is interested in. It's the deaths of Deborahs, little people, whose funerals are perhaps poorly attended, whose obituaries are perhaps never even written. Little people who lived their lives quietly, but whose lives were lived in the service of and for the glory of the triune God. It's those kind of deaths which the world, which gets heaven all abuzz. Well, we've seen then a happy sequel. But secondly, and as I say briefly, a stark contrast in verses 9 to 29. Because you can't see such a stark contrast in this passage. And the contrast is between then verses 9 to 15, where we have Jacob being encountered by God, Jacob being blessed by God, Jacob having his new name reiterated by God, Jacob having the great redemptive promises of God rearticulated to him. Wonderful verse in the whole Jacob story. The contrast between that and then verses 16 to 29, where Jacob suddenly seems to be rocked from crisis to crisis. First, his beloved wife Rachel dying in childbirth. Then his firstborn son Reuben sleeping with his concubine Bilhah. And then finally, his father Isaac dying and being buried. And as I say then, it's a stark contrast. God appears, articulating his promises to Jacob in verses 9 to 15, but then this series of crises in verses 16 to 29. I suppose that the most poignant symbol of this is the story of the two pillars that you have here. In verse 14, Jacob sets up a stone pillar, and there it's to mark a very happy occasion, God having appeared to him and talked with him. But by verse 20, another stone pillar. And this time it's to mark a desperately sad occasion of his beloved wife dying in childbirth. And I think that there are probably two things going on here. First of all, I think we're witnessing here a recurring pattern in the experience of God's people. We're witnessing a recurring pattern in the experience of God's people. Is this, that God never puts his people through crises without first giving them the grace that they need to cope with those crises. He never puts his people through crises without the grace they need to cope with those crises. So here's Jacob. And you see, he is prepared for the death of his wife in childbirth. And he's prepared for Reuben going in and sleeping with his concubine. And he's prepared for the death of his father Isaac. Not in the sense that these things are just like water off a duck's back to him. Of course not. But he's at least more prepared for them than at any other point in his life. Why? Because God has just appeared to him. And God has just blessed him. And God has just reiterated the great redemptive promises to him. And so it's come at the right time. These crises have come on the back of blessing and grace and high points, so that Jacob is much more ready to cope with them than he would have been at another time in his life. Perhaps that you've experienced something in your life. You'd have just fallen to pieces. You'd have said, no, I could never cope with that. There's no way. Thing did come about. God had in some way prepared you for it. In some way you had experienced his grace beforehand, that you were more ready than ever before in your life to cope with that tragedy or that disaster or that sad, sad providence. He's gracious. He doesn't give us more than we can bear. And he prepares us, he equips us for those times of crises, those dark valleys that we have to go through. There's a wonderful know of, Douglas McMurray. Douglas Macmillan speaks about how when he was a young lad, I think he was probably about 15 or 16, his father was dying. And he, the young Douglas, went in to see his father the day before his father died. And he had a very moving conversation with him. And as part of that conversation, his father spoke to him. I have followed Christ. And for years I have prayed for grace to live for Christ, and for 40 years I have prayed for grace to die like a Christian. I've always been afraid secretly, never admitted it, but I've always secretly been afraid that I wouldn't get grace to die. But now I see how stupid I was. God wouldn't give me grace I didn't need until I needed it. God gives us the grace, not before we need it. He didn't give Jacob the grace to cope with the death of his wife and the atrocity of his son Reuben and the burial of his father 10 years before it happened, but in the immediate, he gave him the grace that he needed to cope. So that's the first pattern in the experience of God's people. But secondly, we're witnessing here, I think, the serpent flexing his muscles. The serpent flexing his muscles. What do I mean by that? I think that when the serpent, who the Bible, of course, later calls Satan, when the serpent overheard God's words to Jacob, in verses 11 and 12, the reiteration of those great redemptive promises, I think it struck terror into his heart. And particularly when he heard God including in those promises a detail which he had never included in the promises to Jacob before. Once he had included something similar to Abraham, but never before to Jacob. This detail, kings will come from your body. There in verse 11, kings will come from your body. I think that particularly must have struck terror into the heart of the serpent, because he must have heard in that echoes of those words he had heard before in Genesis chapter 3 verse 15 in the Garden of Eden, when God there had promised a king, a conqueror, described there as the seed of the woman. And what would his task be? It would be to crush the head of the serpent. And as the serpent heard here of God again mentioning the word king, again talking about a coming conqueror, I'm sure that he panicked. I'm sure that, as I say, it struck terror into his heart. This is still on God's agenda. This king is coming, whose role it's going to be to crush my skull. And I think that what we have in verses 16 to 29 then, basically the serpent panicked and desperate, just lashing out in response to those promises that had just been given to Jacob, and particularly that promise of a coming king. And in bringing about then the death of Rachel in childbirth, he's reminding all, particularly Jacob, look, remember, I was the one who brought in there in the Garden of Eden the curse, including the curse on women whose pains would be increased in childbearing. That was my achievement. And it still hasn't been overturned, and women are still suffering in the process of childbearing. He's desperately grabbing on to one of his achievements here, because he's rocked, he's shaken by what God has said to Jacob. And then business of Reuben going in to sleep with his father's concubine. I think it's the serpent basically saying, look, if this is the family from which the king is going to come, I'm going to do all I can to muck up that family, to turn that family in on itself and bring about infighting and division and tension, so that the family won't be in a fit state to produce the coming king who's going to crush my skull. That's why there, down to 26, you have that list. It appears very innocent on the face of things, but look at how it's arranged. strange. It's arranged in terms of the mothers, isn't it? Leah, then Rachel, and then Zilpah, emphasizing, in other words, the dividedness of this family, the tensions within this family. And this is Satan, you see, having kind of a desperate attempt to impede God's plan to bring about this king. Up the family from which that king is going to come. And of course later on he made similar attempts, didn't he? During the time of Esther he tried to wipe out the whole Jewish race from which the king would come. And then specifically at the time of Herod he tried to wipe out all the babies in Bethlehem so that the king wouldn't be able to emerge on the scene. But of course the king did emerge. The king did come. Satan, in all his desperate attempts, couldn't stop him coming. Still he came. And he went to that cross at Calvary, and there he did indeed crush the skull of the serpent. All the serpent's attempts throughout the ages had been to no avail. And now, in the aftermath of Calvary, I think those words of Genesis 3:15 are probably ringing even more loudly in the ears of the serpent. Now he knows himself a defeated force, and now he lashes out even more wildly at us, God's people. But his lashes will always be just as fruitless as they were back here in Genesis 35. And the last word, of course, in this whole story of the serpent and the king goes to Paul there in Romans chapter 16 verse 20. The God of peace will soon crush Satan under your feet. He's a defeated force. Here in Genesis 35, as later on he tried to impede the king coming, but he couldn't do it. And now he tries to at least frustrate the people of the king, the subjects of the king. But he won't do it. He's a beaten force. He's a spent force. The victory has been won. Our king has conquered the serpent. May God help us to believe it. Amen.